you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. Of course, Dr. Jones is the editor of Culture Wars magazine, the author of numerous books, and a frequent lecturer. His books and a subscription to Culture Wars can be purchased at culturewars.com. Good evening, Dr. Jones. How are you doing?
Good, Tim. Good to be here.
Well, thanks for coming back on the show. Well, I guess this is in the June edition of Culture Wars, the article. It's also in an ebook form. Is Christian anti-Semitism responsible for the Poway synagogue shooting?
Yeah.
This piece, I guess this covers the attack by John Ernest, a disillusioned or disaffected young white male who decided to turn to violence. And you cover this incident and I guess its wider implications. So I'll let you start explaining the article to our audience.
Yeah, well, there was a kind of chain of events that happened here. I was approached by Dr. Michael Brown, who said he wanted to have a polite discussion with me about anti-Semitism. So I figured, I don't know how polite this discussion is going to be, but anyway, we got into this discussion, and it turns out that we got into a dispute about the gospel. Brown claims to be a Christian. He talks like a Jew, but he claims to be a Christian. I didn't get a chance to ask him if he were baptized. He says he's been baptized in the Holy Spirit, I think, but I didn't get a chance to ask him if he were baptized by water. But the crux of the matter came down to an interpretation of Scripture. In particular, one passage, 1 Thessalonians 2, where Paul talks about Jews as the people that killed Christ and enemies of the entire human race. Dr. Brown does not like that interpretation. I don't particularly see it as an interpretation. It seems to me that's just the plain sense of the words that he's saying there. But anyway, he got into a discussion where he said that, well, in order to understand this, you have to have the proper word, and the word is not really Jew, it's Judean. Now, there's only one translation that uses the word Judean. Every other word uses the word Jew, but in a sense, he appealed to this as a traditional conservative interpretation of the Bible, whatever that means, the new revised King James, new King James version. But what are you saying here? I wondered. Are you saying that the word Jew is not correct? Well, why are we talking about translations anyway? I mean, it's not as if it was written in some indecipherable tongue. It was written in Greek. And the word is Judaoi, or Judaoi, which is the same word that St. John uses throughout his gospel, and it's the word Jew. So Judean is just kind of a weird distraction from what really is going on in the text. Okay, so that's fine. Okay, but now the problem comes in. If you disagree with Dr. Brown, he will call you an anti-Semite. Now, what am I supposed to do when he calls me an anti-Semite? So we're never going to define the term. I can't call him names because what am I supposed to say to him? He's an anti-Catholic. Who cares whether you're anti-Catholic or not? So he calls me a Christian anti-Semite, which I'm trying to get a word in edgewise there, saying, well, that's a contradiction in terms, because anti-Semitism is a racial term. It was invented by Wilhelm Marr in 1871. And racial terminology makes no sense whatsoever in interpreting the New Testament, because there's a big conflict going on there. Everybody knows that. But both sides have the same DNA. So you're not distinguishing anything by referring to anything racial. The difference is not biological, it's theological. And I tried to say that, therefore, the term anti-Semitism does not apply. If you want to say that the Christians, like St. John, are anti-Jewish, well, of course they are. Because what happened over this period of time is that, if you read the Gospel of St. John, the term Jew becomes reserved for those Jews who rejected Jesus Christ. Now, genetically, biologically, they're all the same. But you come to sentences like, the parents of the man born blind refused to speak out of fear of the Jews, because the Jews threatened to expel from the synagogue anyone who said that Jesus was Lord. Well, the parents of the man born blind were Jews too, in the biological sense. But when St. John uses the word, he's referring to the Jews, the people, the Hebrews who rejected Jesus Christ, and they're now known as Jews. So there's nothing really to talk about here, but he's not going to let this go. And so he insists that I am a Christian anti-Semite because I disagree with his interpretation of 1 Thessalonians 2. So at least we know now what a definition of an anti-Semite is. An anti-Semite is someone who disagrees with a Jew. Before, I said it was someone who criticizes a Jew, and before that, people used to say it was someone who didn't like Jews, but now we've gotten down to the point where an anti-Semite is someone who disagrees with Jews. Okay, 2 days later, the man you mentioned, Mr. Ernest, walks into a synagogue in Poway and starts shooting people. Kills one person. He's arrested, and there's a long manifesto that he writes in which he tries to explain how he's both a white guy and a Christian. So there's two identities. The ones that I just spent a lot of time trying to disconnect, he fuses them together because they're fused together in his mind. So 2 days after that, Dr. Brown issues another video in which he basically holds me responsible for the Poway shooting because I'm a Christian anti-Semite, and because I'm an anti-Semite, I provoke violence. Now, he says this in spite of the fact that I have spent 11 years now stating every time that I reject violence, that I am proposing the traditional teaching of the church, which is sicut judaeus non, which says that no one has the right to harm the Jew. I've said this repeatedly. The ADL, in spite of this fact, denounces me as an anti-Semite, and everyone now is going to hold me responsible for the shooting, even though I've specifically said there is no reason, there's no cause for violence, and no justification for violence. Okay, 2 days after that, the ambassador from Israel shows up at the United Nations, and he announces now that the time for discussion is over. Of course, this is what the man in California was saying too, so they have an agreement here. And we need now to criminalize anti-Semitism. Make it against the law to be an anti-Semite.
Without defining it, right?
Well, no one defines it. No one defines it.
Okay. No.
Part of my argument with Dr. Brown was he said you can't use the word Jew. If you use the word Jew as to use it to describe a group, you are an anti-Semite because there's no such thing as a Jew. Of course, unless you say good things. Now, Dr. Brown has videos out saying how smart Jews are. So obviously he thinks there's a group when there's something good to say about them. But as soon as a goy says something negative, he's an anti-Semite. Okay, now, I was saying there is such a group as the Jews. And here, this is the point of what I'm trying to make here, is that this is how this works. So Dr. Brown can say, has plausible deniability. He said, well, I don't want to send you to jail. I mean, I did call you an anti-Semite, but I don't want to send you to jail. Well, it's not about you, Dr. Brown. I'm not saying you. I'm saying the Jews. And what you do, if you put two and two together here, if you put Dr. Brown, who calls me an anti-Semite, with Ambassador Dannon, who wants anti-Semitism criminalized, then you're dealing with the Jews. And the Jews now are pushing to sending anyone who disagrees with them, no matter what, even if it's their cockamamie interpretation of the New Testament, anyone who disagrees with a Jew will now go to jail if the Jews have their way. Now, what do I mean by the Jews? Do I mean all Jews? No, that is not what the Gospels of St. John said. It's the Jews, which is not all Jews. The Blessed Mother was a Jew. St. John, who also stood at the foot of the cross, they were Jews. Did they shout, crucify him? No. Did the Jewish people shout, crucify him? Yes, they did. And they also said, his blood be on us and our children. So I'm trying to make a distinction here that is part of reality. I get letters on a regular basis from Jews thanking me for what I've done. Some of them have converted to Christianity. Okay, some of them have not. But what you have is there is a logos there. Because they're human beings and we're rational creatures, that is constantly being overridden by an operating system or by software that you would call the Jews, okay? And because you're a membership in this group because you subscribe to what these Jews have. The other word that Brown kept using was Jewish leaders. And I said, yes, there are Jewish leaders, but the only way you can be a Jewish leader is if you have Jewish followers. So you can't absolve the followers because they have a leader. You can't just say it's the leaders. And that is precisely the scene that is described at in the Passion narrative, where the leaders whip up the people into a frenzy and the people say, crucify him. They shout, crucify him. And they say, his blood be on us and our children. So that's the situation as it exists right now. And now we are faced with states across the country, Jews, the Jews, using organizations like the ADL and IPAC and all of their political organizations to basically push for criminalization of anyone who disagrees with them. And I'm saying this is inimical. It's antithetical to everything that we believe as Americans. No one should be able to force his interpretation of the Bible on anyone. Okay. You offer it, but you can't force it on anyone. So that's where we stand now.
Yeah, you mentioned making it illegal, and there's legislation, the most recent law that was passed, signed by the governor, I believe, late last month, the Florida anti-Semitism bill, passed unanimously in the House and the Senate, 114-0 and 44-0. And the bill requires additional institutions to treat anti-Semitism an identical manner to discrimination motivated by race. Basically, it's illegal to accuse Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to allege priorities of Jews worldwide than to the interest of their own nation. Well, that's a common critique, or criticism of Zionism, because it inevitably creates dual loyalty if Zionists decide to take residency in other government, in other countries. Drawing comparisons of contemporary Israel policy to the Nazis. So if you make an artful or comparison between what's going on in Gaza to maybe to, you know, what was going on in the Polish, you know, the Warsaw Ghetto, is illegal. I mean, you can disagree with the comparison, but it certainly shouldn't be illegal. Criticizing basically, yeah, the bill also adds definition of anti-Semitism similar to the definition adopted by the U.S. Department of State Special Envoy to monitor combat anti-Semitism. So we have a federal agency or federal position that's dedicated to specifically combating anti-Semitism. So this is an affront or an assault on the First Amendment.
Obviously.
It passed unanimously and the governor signed it.
Well, the fact is that the Israel lobby controls these state legislators. It's obvious. I mean, this is preposterous. A unanimous approval of a bill that flagrantly violates the First Amendment of the Constitution, guaranteeing freedom of speech and freedom of religion. I mean, all I can think of is that they all stood there with their fingers crossed behind their back. And they said, well, look, the Supreme Court's going to overturn it anyway, so who cares? Because I think that's what's going to happen. The anti-BDS bill has already passed. Mm-hmm. It was struck down in Texas. That bill made it a requirement of employment that you had to say you wouldn't criticize Israel or engage in the boycott of Israel. The judge struck it down as unconstitutional. There's no way in the world that the courts are going to pass this. If they do, it will be the end, the complete end of the American experiment, because the First Amendment is all we have left anymore. You may have noticed we don't celebrate the 4th of July anymore. In South Bend, we celebrate gay pride. Every parade that gets celebrated here is a gay pride celebration. Yesterday, we had a gay pride march on Father's Day. Now, if there's one group that does not contribute to fathering children, it's the homosexual. Maybe I'm missing something here, but that's the way it is. So we've seen the triumph of identity politics, and the triumph here now will mean the end of America. So I'm putting my money on the fact that the courts will overturn it and it will not pass, and that this will be a high watermark of foreign intrusion into our country that will astound people of future generations of how it got this far.
Yeah, I was reading, I think, some bullet points in Culture Wars magazine, and one bullet point, I think this was in February edition, goes, why is there so much concern about Russian efforts to influence American elections, but so little concern about Israeli efforts?
Right.
And legislation like this kind of proves critics of Israel and Jewish power proves their point. I mean, this is so audacious and so in your face.
You know, right.
No debate. Unanimously?
I mean, that's preposterous. What? Unanimous? What, are you kidding me? And so it's exactly analogous to that shameful incident when Benjamin Netanyahu showed up and gave the address to the American Congress. And you had the lackeys in the Congress giving him 26 standing ovations.
Well, don't start changing. I think it was 29.
I'm sorry.
Well,
must have been one tired group of legislators at the end of the day. They probably hadn't got that much exercise in their lifetime, in recent history.
Well, forgive them. They were merely following orders.
So. Well, that's what the New York Times said afterwards. They said it wasn't because Benjamin Netanyahu was a great orator. It's because IPAC lackeys were in the audience taking roll. And if you didn't stand up and cheer, IPAC would cut you out of their money, and then they'd fund a candidate to run against you because you weren't 100% for Israel.
Yeah. I heard this bill, the Florida bill, there was a ceremonial signing bill in Jerusalem.
Wait a minute. I didn't know Jerusalem. I knew that Miami was the Jewish capital of the United States. But I didn't know Jerusalem had moved to Florida. This is unbelievable. Unbelievable. Why is it only people like on the lunatic fringe like you and me who are talking about this? Why isn't everyone talking about this? Doesn't anyone believe in America anymore? I mean, I remember this is not far-fetched. I mean, the man who founded conservatism was Russell Kirk. And he gave a speech at the Philadelphia Society when he said Tel Aviv was not the capital of the United States of America. And he was wrong. It is the capital of the United States of America. And that was the end of him as a conservative figure. The neocons excommunicated him from the Philadelphia Society, and he lived the rest of his life in Macosta, Michigan, in obscurity.
That's the price of it, isn't it?
That's right.
Dynamic That's right. silence, as they say.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, in this young man's manifesto, though, he brings up the issue of racial anxiety, sort of this concern over displacement of white or heritage America and all that entails. It's kind of funny because he addresses some of the things you address in your work, like the use of minority groups, or you know, blacks or Hispanics or whatever, as proxy warriors or useful, you know, proxies to engage some sort of ethnic warfare. Because you know, you've detailed this in many of your books, like Slaughter of Cities and also right. Your biography, John Carter Kroll. There is ethnic cleansing going on. There is social engineering, which a lot of, I think, the white what's called the white nationalist movement now is a reaction to.
Right.
And there's demographic or warfare, weaponized migration. But I was reading the excerpts of his manifesto, and it was somewhat sophisticated in his analysis.
Right. He's a smart guy. It's just he's been given nothing to work with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have the greatest mind in the world, but if you don't know, if you haven't been given the right categories or the right principles or the right vocabulary, you're not going to come up with anything. And the one thing he could not figure out was how Christianity fit in with being white. I mean, you can be Irish and Catholic, and there's no conflict between those two identities. But you can't be white and Catholic because they're two conflicting identities. They are the same thing. They are both kind of religious identities. And he didn't understand that. And so he's constantly trying to figure out how those parts fit together, and he's not being successful. Now, the greatest triumph of the social engineers was to get people to identify as white. Because as soon as you identify as white, you're a racist. And as soon as you're a racist, then you lose all your rights whatsoever, and they can do whatever they want to you. The classic example of that was Charlottesville in your neck of the woods. Those guys were like lambs being led to the slaughter. They didn't understand what they were doing. They thought they were just innocent and protesters. You know, they were going to defend Robert E. Lee and his statue and white identity. And they walked into the machine gun fire. That's part of the tragedy of what we're going on here. They've created the American social engineers, basically destroyed everyone's ethnic identity. They destroyed regional identity. They destroyed the identity of the South. And then when the people had nothing left, they just started identifying themselves as white. And then they played right into the hands of the people that wanted to destroy them. So this guy unwittingly ends up putting a weapon into the hands of his enemies, and they will use it against him. I guarantee you that. And that's precisely what happened in Charlottesville. You're talking about the collapse of standard identities and people looking around for something else and falling into a trap that has been prepared for them.
Yeah, and not only are they denying one's ethnic identity, or religious identity, even their sexual identity. You're going after male, female as a concrete, real flesh and blood reality, which it is. But the fact that you can make war on reality with just language and neologisms and slogans is incredible, you know.
Right, and now we're seeing the same thing on the internet. The great purge of the internet that's taking place now. Social media, and it's all based on hate. The term hate, in particular, hate speech. Again, we're back at where we were with anti-Semitism in more ways than one. Okay, first of all, the term has no meaning whatsoever. It's simply empty term which you fill up with bullets which you aim at your enemy. You are the one who creates the meaning of the term. Now, wait a minute. I said you are the one. That's not true. I don't mean Tim Kelly creates the meaning. The term hate speech was created by the ADL.
Mm-hmm.
It was created as a parallel term to anti-Semitism, which you can expand now to include race and gender and sexual orientation and so on and so forth.
Yeah, they have words like transphobic.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. So basically, you're taking a concept like anti-Semitism, and now you're expanding it. No content, but expanded reach.
Well, even like heteronormative, which would describe a person who's naturally attracted to the opposite sex, has gotten married, has had children, and raising a family. And when you say you're heteronormative as opposed to transgender, they're putting it on an equal plane, as if these are co-equal categories that we almost tolerate. You know,
yes.
You know, which is again a part of that war on use of the weaponization of language.
You know. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about Jewish privilege. I mean, people talk about white privilege. Well, that doesn't exist. Identifying yourself as white, it means you lost the argument. You have lost. So there's no such thing as white privilege. Whether there ever was in the past is beside the point. There is no such thing right now. But there is something called Jewish privilege. But you're not allowed to talk about it because they don't want you to talk about it. You can, as I said before, if you're a Jew, you can say to someone, you're an anti-Semite, and you will wreck that guy's career if he's got one. And there's nothing you can do about it. It's that simple. You're completely helpless because they have Jewish privilege. Okay? And now you're seeing the same thing being expanded on the internet with hate speech. They are in the throes of kicking people off. Facebook issued guidelines. Actually, they didn't issue them. They were internally issued, and Breitbart published them. And there's no, it just goes around in circles.
Yeah, this guy is ridiculous. It's just no meaning.
There's no way to, and what you're seeing is this kind of flailing around. So they obviously, they can't define the term, okay? But that doesn't mean they can't use it. And so recently, a blogger, he's a lefty, I think, by the name of Tim Pool, did a YouTube video in which he got actually the email from April Glazer, who is a so-called journalist from Slate. So April writes to one of the executives at Chase Bank, and she says, your payment tech, Chase Payment Tech, handles the account of the Proud Boys. The Proud Boys have been identified by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group. What's your policy on a deadline, April? Well, this is the crudest type of information. In other words, I'm going to write an article calling you a bad person, and you've got 15 minutes to respond. So what happened is within 24 hours, the Proud Boys were kicked off the platform. Now, wait a minute. What are we talking about here? Well, it's Jewish privilege again. Now, I don't know whether April Glazer is Jewish, but I know that the Southern Poverty Law Center is a Jewish organization, and they are in the business of enforcing the so-called hate speech crimes, convicting people of hate speech. They are so reckless in this regard that they have basically wrecked their own organization. Well,
for which there's no due process, nor is there an appeal.
No due process. You have no appeal whatsoever here. If this were the local district attorney, you could call a lawyer and you could defend yourself. You have no defense whatsoever here against these people.
If this were the Inquisition, you'd have a defense.
Inquisition, you have a lot more defense.
Yes.
And so this is terrorism. This is terrorism. This is violence.
Well, what if, I mean, I think you raised this example. I think one your recent talk you had, you said, what if, you know, Bill Donahue of the Catholic League had written a similar letter accusing a group of being anti-Catholic and demanding, suggesting Chase Manhattan should do something. Like you said, there wouldn't have been the same reaction, right?
No, they would have laughed.
Yeah.
Because there's no such thing as Catholic privilege. There's no such thing as white privilege. But there is such a thing as Jewish privilege, and I'm giving examples of it right now. Whether it's Dr. Brown, whether it's Ambassador Dannon, whether it's Slate Magazine invoking the Southern Poverty Law Center. These people have power over life and death. They can ruin your life. They can absolutely ruin your life.
And then they claim when the bank, you know, deplatforms them or cuts off their financial services to them, or YouTube shuts down a channel or whatever, Facebook deplatforms you, oh, it's the free market.
Yeah, except that you have a monopoly position in the free market.
Yeah.
That's the whole point. It's like Amazon. Yeah, sure. Try to go to another bookstore. Well, all the bookstores have disappeared because of Amazon. So this is the whole point. You've created such a powerhouse here that you dominate the market. And the government always used to step in at a certain point and bust up the trust. You know, if they had such monopoly power, that's not in the common good. And they can just but now these social platforms have monopoly power, pretty much. You know, you can say, okay, you can go to some other place, but they just don't have the marketplace that YouTube has. So it's not fair. Okay, and when you do something to someone that's not fair, they get angry. And when some people get angry, they pick up a gun and they start shooting. So what you're saying here is you're causing the violence. I'm saying it. I'm saying you're causing the violence. Because you're giving these people the sense that it's a hopeless situation, that talking doesn't get you anywhere, that nobody's listening to you anyway, you're a loser, you're a white guy, and so on and so forth. And that's the cause of violence now. I think it's very simple.
And you also make the good point is that many of these Jewish organizations, particularly the State of Israel, give what you call bloody instruction.
Well, yeah. So, as I said before, you know, you say this guy goes into a synagogue and he starts shooting Jews. And you say that's wrong. Well, I agree with you. That's wrong. But when the snipers in Israel shoot women and children or a man. I saw it. I saw the video myself with my own eyes. The man is shot in the back. He's heading away from the wall. Okay. Shot in the back. That's a war crime. And that's exactly what the United Nations said that was committed. These were atrocities committed by the State of Israel. But Israel has, you know, the most powerful nation in the world backing it up. And so they just laugh at groups like the United Nations and they laugh at your moral law, but as you said, they teach bloody instructions. So that's the right-wing Jew. And then you talk to the left-wing Jew, and he thinks that abortion is a right. Abortion is the murder of an unborn child. So you got these two groups saying that you have a right, they have a right to murder people. And then you've got people who the organization in Pittsburgh, at least, said that they had the right to break the law, the immigration law, because they answered to a higher calling. They believed in tikkun olam, in healing the world, which means basically imposing their revolutionary views on everyone else and making you feel morally inferior if you don't go along with them. So you put all these things together, and basically you're telling everyone that if it's a problem, you can go kill somebody to solve your problem. Well, if it's wrong, if it's wrong to for this guy to go into this synagogue in Pittsburgh and shoot Jews, why is it okay for Jews to shoot Palestinians? Why is that okay? There's a double standard here, and people aren't stupid, and people are going to react in, I guess, ways that are becoming predictable now. They're going to react with violence. Every time you do something like this, you're promoting violence in our culture. So why is it that there's only one side that gets held accountable for violence when we're talking about hate speech on the internet? Why aren't we talking about Israel's behavior? Why aren't we talking about abortion? Why aren't we talking about Antifa? So at Charlottesville, there was one group that did seem bent on violence when they showed up there, and that was Antifa. So now we have this lawyer, Roberta Kaplan, who's a lesbian and a Jew, who is now filing lawsuits claiming that the white people went to Charlottesville with the intent to murder. I find that hard to believe. Okay, I find that preposterous. Okay, now she's going to try and prove that in a court of law. Okay, but I think there is a group that did go there with violence in mind, and it was Antifa, and she's completely silent on Antifa. Why isn't she filing lawsuits against Antifa? Many people have said they are a violent and intrinsically violent group that is engaged in act of violence across the country.
Yeah, so there's a federal case to be made too, yeah.
Right. There is a case, and there is a case, I seem to remember this from a YouTube video, where it's a guy, this guy's an Antifa, he's a Jew, identifies himself as Jew, and then he says, I'm a communist. I'm a communist, motherfucker. I'm a communist. This goes on and on in this regard. Well, it turns out this guy actually assaulted a group of Hispanics and is now going to be involved in jail. Now, where is this? Why do we have this blind spot? Well, because this is Jewish revolutionary activity, and that's not violence. That's tikkun olam. So all of these things are completely arbitrary. They're complete double standards. And yet we are supposed to accept them without a murmur of protest. Well, this can't go on. I'm sorry. This can't go on this way.
Well, yeah, there is a – it's funny because if you look at the idea of free speech and free expression in the United States, the First Amendment historically it was thought of applying to political speech and didn't really apply to things like pornography and obscenity. And the way it's been distorted in recent years is it's broadly interpreted to support pornography and obscenity, and they're sort of narrowing the field of free speech. That's the interpretation of the law. And you know, a lot of these people, particularly Jewish activists, were vocal advocates of free speech when they could be used to sort of deconstruct, tear down institutions, to disrupt society. But when free speech is used to fight back, then they become advocates of censorship. That's right. Yeah.
What's the word we're looking for? Hypocrisy? This is the rankest form of hypocrisy. It's the rankest form of double standard. And I'm sorry, but people are not that stupid that they're not starting to recognize this now. This is intolerable to have a group of hypocrites like this imposing their double standard on us and trying to make us feel guilty because of what? Because we're objecting to their form of tyranny? I'm sorry. Those days are over. They're over. And largely, they're over because of the internet. And that's why they're upset about the internet.
Yeah. But it's well thought out. This isn't a blind spot. This is bad faith. I mean, it wasn't Herbert Marcuse who came up with the idea of repressive tolerance?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And if you want to talk about who's responsible for redefining speech to include pornography, it's the Jews. I mean, from start to finish, because they were the ones in the industry and they were the ones who benefited financially from this. But they also benefit politically, as we're seeing now. So when it was, let's say, in the 60s and they had a film like I Am Curious Yellow or something like that, you would always find someone like Norman Mailer coming up and saying what a great work of art it was.
Yes, art. Yeah.
or let's 30 years later. You have two feminists who are Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, who are now saying pornography is sexist. Well, who comes to the rescue of the pornographers at this point? It's none other than Betty Friedan, or Betty Goldstein Friedan, who was a communist in her youth. And now she is coming to defend the pornographer against fellow feminists and basically denouncing them as not being real feminists because they're not on board with pornography. So it's been constant in this regard, a constant subversion of the moral order and somehow making you feel guilty if you don't go along with this thing. Why are we not talking about pornography as violence? Why is this discussion, this Silicon Valley discussion, this preposterous Facebook posturing, the preposterous, obnoxious posturing of a guy like Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, wagging his finger at us with this air of moral superiority because he's a homosexual and we're not? Why are we not talking about pornography as violence? Why are we not talking about deplatforming pornography? Why? Tell me, answer that question.
Well, there's a reason why it's free now, right? Virtually, right?
It is virtually free. Yeah. Why? And why are we not talking about deplatforming pornographers? Because the Jews control pornography. That's why. And so everywhere you look, it comes back to the same old story, whether it's hate speech, whether it's anti-Semitism, whatever it is, it's the Jews trying to control the narrative in their interest and wagging their finger at you as if they have some type of air of moral superiority.
Well, this is the same situation where if you criticize their advocacy of pornography, historical advocacy and leadership in promoting it, you're being an anti-Semitic. But if they're writing about it in terms of being progressive and liberating, and they take credit for it, then it's a good thing, and you know they don't have any problem taking
credit for it. Right, we're making exactly the same statement. I've said this before. Professor Abrams took my article on Jewish involvement in pornography and basically put a whole cloth into his article, and all he did was change the conclusion. So I said it's bad. He said it's good. Well, that's the difference. That's why I'm an anti-Semite, and he probably got a raise for publishing an article for the same, making the same statement. This is intolerable. This is intolerable. We can't go on this way.
And you said that you should. This is just going to lead to more violence and more repression. That's the dialectic here.
Then the question is: well, are you consciously trying to do this? Now, of course, there are. Lenin did have a whole theory of basically increase. That's a point of terrorism.
Yeah.
Under the Bolsheviks, people like Lenin and Trotsky would create terrorist incidents so that there would be reprisal on the part of the government, which would then in turn create another terrorist incident. And this created a dialectic which was supposed to lead to revolution. So I'm sure that idea wasn't lost on the people who are alive today. I can see the same thing type of happening. I've already said it's the dialectic is right there between Ambassador Dannon and Mr. Ernest. They feed off of each other. And we're caught in the middle, in the crossfire, because we want to continue the discussion. And we say, no, we have a right to talk about this, and you shouldn't be able to shut us down. And if you do shut us down, you're going to create more violence. It's that simple.
And I guess, you know, this is when you have a group that is a categorized, a victimized, specially protected group, they in essence become privileged. And then they ironically, they're supposed to be oppressed, but they're the privileged group. They're the ones that the laws and same standards don't apply to. And then they use their position once they get into power to repress you. We see this with homosexuals.
Right. That's called homosexual privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're seeing is like our illustrious gay mayor, Pete Buttigieg, who now at the drop of a hat will lecture you about what a bad person you are and harangue you by saying that he has a more traditional marriage than Donald Trump. And everybody just, you know, he gets invited on Meet the Press to make preposterous claims like this. There's only one explanation. It's homosexual privilege. It's that simple. And there's a link between homosexual privilege and Jewish privilege. And that is because the homosexual is now the avant-garde of the world revolution. He is the proxy warrior for the Jewish revolutionary spirit right now in our day. So it used to be Bolshevism in Russia in the early 20th century. Now it's homosexuality. And you are not allowed to criticize a homosexual. You're not allowed to criticize a Jew because they are both memberships in related privileged groups.
Yeah, this the use of the language. And when I started hearing equivalency of racism, anti-Semitism, and homophobia, you saw that like the ADL and SPLC using that. And whatever homophobia meant was someone who wasn't comfortable with or wasn't sufficiently enthusiastic about the homosexual lifestyle or being promoted. And now you're homophobic if you're not wearing a rainbow shirt on Rainbow Day at your corporate job. It's being who gave the month of June to homosexuals, by the way?
Who gave what?
Who gave the month of June to homosexuals?
Don't know.
When was that decision taken?
I don't know.
I didn't get the memo.
I didn't get it either. They didn't ask me for my permission either. But what you're seeing is the extinction of any type of solidarity whatsoever. What you're seeing is the extinction of the American. The American no longer exists, certainly not in South Bend, Indiana, because we don't celebrate the 4th of July anymore. Every parade is a gay pride parade. And the month of July, or was it June? I forget which one it was, was dedicated. The city government put all of its resources behind the celebration of sexual deviance. And the net result was that people just depart. They leave the public square. There's no group identity anymore. This is the triumph of identity politics. The irony, of course, is that now the identity, the group, is minuscule compared to the majority. But I mean, that's, in a sense, the whole point of the thing. How do you get minorities, minorities like the Jews, basically get around majority rule in a country like the United States? How do they do that? Well, we're seeing how they do it. The first way is to ban speech that they don't like, and then completely dominate the discourse by creating bogus terms like anti-Semitism or hate speech. That's the way they dominate the discourse, because suddenly you're talking their language and you'll never reach any conclusion because there's nothing there.
And also the ruthless violation of public trust, infiltration of public institutions like public schools, libraries, government agencies, and to further their interests.
Yeah, so now we have gay drag queens reading to young children at the public library in South Bend, Indiana, because they did it someplace else, and we have to be like everyone else. These are people, these are the proxy warriors of the oligarchs. This is the way tyranny operates in our day. This is the way a small minority imposes its will on the majority in our day. If you can't figure this out, you're hopeless. You don't understand what's going on.
Well, they want to cut you off from any ethnic identity, community, and family, so you're atomized. And you've said it. It's to make everyone, they may not be an actual homosexual, but they have, their living patterns are like a homosexual, with sterile sexual experience, you know, no children, no family, no concern for posterity, so you can be a wage slave.
Right. And so it didn't start with homosexuality. It started with contraception. Mm-hmm. 50, 60 years ago. That was the big push back then. And once you accepted that, then homosexuality was the inexorable conclusion that people had to draw, because you are the one who separated procreation from sexual activity. And if that's the case, if that's okay, well, then you can't object to homosexuality.
Yeah. And also the certain mythos of sort of a being an oppressed group, you know, homosexuals have Stonewall, and the myth behind that. And of course, Jewish history is full of sort of self-serving, lachrymose history of, you know, them being oppressed.
Right.
You know,
and neither group ever does anything wrong.
Yeah.
Neither group. There's no such thing as it's. And so this was reinforced through Hollywood. The only couples that never fought were the homosexual couples. And they were always superior, and everyone was supposed to just accept this. And it did have an effect on the population.
Yeah, we're talking 30, 40 years of social conditioning.
That's right.
It was gradual, and you know,
at least.
Yeah.
And so I've just finished the chapter on Hegel in the Logos book, and he said that the state was the vehicle of Logos in history, or Vernunft in history. And so the United States is then the vehicle of history, and it's come down to basically Marquette Avenue in South Bend, because it's me and Pete Buttigieg as the two, as the dialectic, and we both live on Marquette Avenue. Isn't this uncanny how history can focus itself on these two antitheses in the dialectic? Pete Buttigieg is in many ways the fullest expression of that whole revolutionary activity. And he came by it through his father, who was the Gramsci scholar at Notre Dame, and also the man who introduced Michel Foucault at Notre Dame.
And we're seeing Michel Foucault's ghost. That's sort of the corruption of leftist politics. Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody, left means Foucault.
Yeah.
So, you know,
sexual liberation, you know, there's no real demand for like a workers' rights or higher wages.
Gone. The left no longer talks about economic justice or anything like that. They talk about sexual politics. And Pete Buttigieg is the complete expression of that. And I am the complete expression of the opposite. And the opposite of that is logos. And that's what I'm talking about. So it's come down to this. You can't have one without the other. The one, maybe I'm too Hegelian at this point, but the one in a sense generates the other. And so obviously Pete is almost 40 years younger than me, but I'm the same age as his father. And I saw what was happening there. And my whole career is basically a reaction to what happened at Notre Dame, St. Mary's, and Catholic education over this period of time. Mm-hmm. And he is the expression of the subversion of that, the subversion of that now being broadcast on a national level. So that's the conflict right now.
Well, interesting. What the U.S. represents these days is international sodomy, where Botswana announced, I guess it was under pressure from the U.S. State Department.
Do you think so?
They have decriminalized sodomy or homosexuality. And this is something that we should take pride in. No pun intended.
Yes. God bless those Botswanans, wherever they are. Unfortunately for the State Department, Kenya did not. I was in Kenya. I know where it is. And Kenya did not strike down its anti-sodomy laws. Probably because Kenya is right next to Uganda, and all of East Africa is basically a function of the Ugandan martyrs.
Does that mean Taylor Swift's going to cancel a concert in Kenya? Well, this is how it worked. Taylor Swift apparently gave some sort of pride concert. I saw the headline, but this is
actually. I think that what we're going to see here in the United States on abortion is the return to states' rights. Because we're seeing places like Georgia pass these draconian anti-abortion bills. And New York is passing the opposite kind of bill. And so basically the message of both Governor Cuomo and whoever is in charge in Georgia is basically, if you don't like it, go someplace else.
Which is a practical solution, I guess.
I think the Supreme Court is sending signals to the states that they are willing to come up with a states' rights compromise on abortion.
Yeah, that's an interesting legal strategy. I was reading about that, because when I first heard about it, there's no way the court's going to overturn Roe v. Wade, stare decisis and these things. But the states can expand definitions of liberty. And so if you expand liberty, recognizing the humanity of the fetus, that'll give the court a reason to not necessarily overturn Roe v. Wade, but the same way that Plessy v. Ferguson technically Plessy v. Ferguson wasn't overturned. Separate but equal was found to be sound, but never implemented. And the court could engage some sort of legal legerdemain to justify an effective overturning Roe v. Wade and a reversion to the states. It's interesting. It's hope, you know, see if that happens.
I think that's the only solution. It's been now, what are we going on, 50 years now of abortion? And there is no consensus whatsoever.
Yeah.
Much to the consternation of Madam Justice Ginsburg.
Yes.
Who is upset. Why are the goyim being so stubborn? Why don't they just go along with the Jewish plan and accept abortion as the greatest thing that ever happened here? It's liberation for women, isn't it? Even though you're killing women.
It's our low IQs.
So the people are not going along. They're never going to go along. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the geography of abortion, in these states, the Bible Belt, very few or if any abortions occur, and most of them occur in sort of, you know, the bicoastal, godless right. Bicoastal area.
Abortion and New York and California. Yeah. It was Jewish in both places. This is Bernard Nathanson's testimony. He was the Jew in New York who orchestrated that change there. California was the same thing.
I think Planned Parenthood has, they decided to, in response to this, they tried to create like abortion super centers because they can't, because in these states that are more traditional, abortionists are more or less chased out. And so although.
Yeah. Well, that's what happened in South Bend. And,
yeah.
our mayor showed his true colors when he overrode the city council, the voice of the people, and allowed for the rezoning for an abortion clinic. Mm-hmm. So I remember a sign. It was during the Proposition 9 protest, and it was a lady. She's holding up a sign, San Francisco, and the sign said, "I came here to get away from people like you." And I think that's the wave of the future.
Yeah.
I think it's basically, you can say that universally. You can say it in Georgia and you can say it in New York City. And it will apply in both places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we came here to get away from New York City and you went to New York City to get away from here. So what's the problem?
So why did the Supreme Court impose the values of New York City and California on, you know, Alabama, Georgia?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. Because that is in effect what social engineering was. And I think what we're seeing here is the failure of social engineering. We're never going to have consensus on this thing. You went too far. It's not going to happen. And I think that the same thing will happen with homosexuality.
Well, a lot of these problems that we face, I think the grammar you provide in your books, particularly with urban renewal and the weaponization of integration, these things, is a lot of these problems, if not solved, can be reduced greatly if we stop social engineering people, letting people live where they want to live and trying to direct their lives, and decentralizing, going back to a more traditional model, the way the United States was supposed to be, as opposed to sort of this, you know, homogenous imperial system that we have today, which is unsustainable.
So you're saying that those states really did have differences back then? Is
yes.
that what you're saying?
Yes. In the final analysis, it's healthy, I guess.
I was in your state, and I went to the battle of the battlefield of Bull Run.
Oh, you're near my house.
And they would say, and this is where the regiment from New York stood and fought the regiment from North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So even there, there was no, everybody was from a state.
Yes.
It was a little bit like Switzerland. You know, you can't become a Swiss citizen unless you become a citizen of a canton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's sort of the way the United States was. And now we're seeing the whole, I think we're heading back in that direction. I think it's going to be the return of the repressed.
Well, it's a reasonable accommodation to all parties involved. Why force people to live together if they're so diametrically opposed? And quite frankly, you know, if you look at some of the liberal states, whether it be that California, San Francisco, New York, let chips fall where they may. How long will they be sustain themselves living the way they want to live? I mean, you shouldn't impose your system and make them subsidize your degenerate lifestyle. You know.
And yes.
You know, decentralized system is just more sustainable and it's more just in the final analysis in all its imperfections, you know. So
yeah, instead of imposing sodomy on the entire nation. Doesn't it seem more reasonable than that?
Mhm. Instead, you know, but now we have the rainbow flag flying over the embassy in Berlin.
I saw that. I saw that with my own eyes.
Then convincing the rest of the world, I mean, the argument that we indeed are the great Satan when that happens.
Yes, yes.
I mean, there was a interesting piece. Now, what we're seeing is inordinate Jewish power, its exertions, corruption of the American political system, both domestic and foreign policy. I was reading a piece by Phil Giraldi recently, and maybe we'll close out on this. We'll come up on an hour. Get your comment on this. He's talking about his Trump's foreign policy team, and Trump's A team in the Middle East is headed by his Jewish son-in-law Jared Kushner, who is personally advised by a group of Orthodox Jews. David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, is also an Orthodox Jew and a former bankruptcy lawyer with no diplomatic or foreign policy credentials. He's a passionate supporter and even a funder of illegal Israeli settlements on the West Bank and on the Golan Heights. Friedman endlessly and ignorantly repeats Israeli government talking points and eventually succeeded in changing the language used in the State Department's communications and eliminating the word occupied when describing Israel's control of the West Bank. His humanity does not extend beyond his Jewishness. Defending the Israeli shooting of thousands of unarmed Gaza protesters and the bombing of schools, hospitals, and cultural centers. How he represents the United States and its citizens who are not dual nationalists, nationals must be considered a mystery. Friedman's top advisor is Rabbi Aryeh Lightstone, who is described by the embassy as an expert in Jewish education and pro-Israeli advocacy. Once upon a time, Lightstone described Donald Trump as posing an existential danger both to the Republican Party and to the U.S. He even accused him of pandering to Jewish audiences. Apparently, when the opportunity knocked, he changed his mind and about his new boss. Pre-government in 2014, Lightstone founded and headed a Silent City, a Jewish advocacy group supported by extreme right-wing money that opposed the Iran nuclear agreement and also worked to combat the nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Trump's chief international negotiator for the Middle East is yet another Orthodox Jew named Jason Greenblatt, the former Trump organization lawyer. If you had read a recent New York Times op-ed by Greenblatt entitled "Care About Gaza? Blame Hamas," you would understand that the misery being experienced by the Palestinians in Gaza has nothing to do with Israeli snipers, artillery rounds, and phosphorus bombs. It's all the Arabs' own fault. Greenblatt uniquely claims that Israel's illegal settlements are not an obstacle to peace, and he is very upset because some naysayers are actually putting part of the blame for the human catastrophe in Gaza on Israel. Kushner, Greenblatt, and Friedman are all perfect examples of the type of dual loyalist who cannot appreciate that their overriding religious and ethnic allegiances are incompatible with genuine loyalty to the United States. The other key pro-Israeli players in the foreign policy establishment are nominally Christian, including Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, both of whom are Christian Zionists who believe and hope that the recreation of Israel is part of a biblical prophecy that will lead to a great war and the end of the world as we know it in the second coming of Christ. Not exactly a model of diversity, is it?
No.
So, sorry for the long quote, but I thought it was worthwhile. So,
yeah, I was with Phil and Mashad a year ago, and we were watching those Israelis gun down Palestinians on the TV screen behind us during the conference.
Yeah, but that's the level of, this is sort of accepted now, isn't it? This type of level of influence and control in U.S. foreign policy and apparently domestic policy, as we see these state laws.
Well, didn't you say that if you object to this, you're an anti-Semite? Isn't that the law now in Florida?
Yes, to point this out, to object to it, to question loyalty. He's questioning the loyalty. So if Phil was employed by some educational institution in Florida, he'd be in violation of the law because he's questioning the loyalty of these Jewish gentlemen.
Yes. A man who served his country. Anyway, Phil, don't go to Florida.
Yeah. So that's where we are. We're coming up on an hour. So the article, where'd I write that? What's the title of the article again?
Is Christian anti-Semitism the cause of the Poway synagogue shootings? It's available on Kindle as an ebook.
Okay, and also in the June issue of Culture Wars, correct?
It's also in the June issue of Culture Wars, so you have two opportunities to get this. You can subscribe to Culture Wars magazine, or you can buy it as an ebook and read it on your Kindle.
And should we expect the Logos of History and the History of Logos to be ready to fill someone's oversized Christmas?
Yeah, so don't buy a doorstop. And don't worry about pressing those flowers either. I'm hoping that the book will be out by the end of the year.
Perfect. Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
My pleasure.
I'll post this. I'll send you the link. I'll post it soon, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Thanks, Tim.
Have a nice summer.
Okay. Always a pleasure.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.